Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Macko and Cause podcast. It's the palindrome episode. It's episode 202. How you doing, Bob?
I'm good, Matthew. It's nice to be here today. It's a beautiful morning in Toronto. Got a brand new set of headphones. I'm excited to try them out. Let's do this. Hello?
So, yeah. No. I gotcha.
Did I just blow you away with that?
Well, as someone who... Let's talk about headphones.
Okay.
Because there are certain things I spend money on. Basically, only wine and food. So, I still have the white earbuds that I only hear out of one ear. Only out of the right ear. And I've been doing this for like the last 3 months, and I refuse to change.
I find that hard to believe.
It's just something I just don't care about, even though I know I should. But I always have bad luck with headphones. I break them all the time. It's just not for me.
Umbrellas, headphones, and glasses. These three things are, don't get close. Mm-hmm. Don't get close. They are like the red shirt of household items.
Yeah.
They'd make it to the planet's surface only to be killed.
Oh, yeah. It's true. Actually, it's funny you say umbrella. I have to go get a new umbrella. We had one for like 3 months and Amy broke it.
You sound so upset about it. 3 months is actually a pretty good run for an umbrella.
I have to go back to Canadian Tire. I hate Canadian Tire.
Okay. How much are you spending on this umbrella? Does it even cost as much as two glasses of wine at a fancy restaurant?
No. This umbrella will be like $85-$90.
Okay, so three glasses then.
Three glasses. If you get like, they always have those special wines that they got the Corvin, that, hey, you want to try this 20-year-old Bordeaux? All right, it's $28 a glass.
Matthew, you are full of shit. But don't take that personally because you're in good company. We all are. But the way you are is you act like you wouldn't waste money on something silly, right? Why would I waste money on earphones or umbrellas or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But you will waste money on stuff you like, and you will do it with impunity.
Yes.
I think if we actually saw a tally of what you spend, most of us would be shocked. Maybe even stop listening to the pod.
I am. You're not wrong. By the way, I think the description of this one's going to be, Matt, you're full of shit, but don't take it personally. I think that's going to be the header. So let's go down here for a second. What are the things that would just, you don't want to know if the great gods above gave you the final tally? Like, for me, one would be the amount of wine I've paid, money I've spent on wine, or like, the amount of hours I've spent watching, say, certain TV shows that I've already seen three times before.
Oh, newsletters. I think that when I go to heaven, if I don't get in, it's going to be because of all the newsletters that I subscribe to and then never read. My inbox is full of them. Like hundreds of, I'll read one article and I'll be like, oh, that's interesting. I should subscribe. Click, move on. And then, 250 emails later, nothing. Nothing's been read. I used to do this with magazines, but, now that everything's... You remember what I was like with magazines.
Yes. But,
I'd buy dozens of them. But now that I'm online, I don't need to do that. I still go through dozens of magazines, but they're all online. So, definitely newsletter subscriptions. Oh, I'm awful when it comes to those.
It needs to be said, whenever we moved offices at Off the Record, always the hardest part was your stupid fucking magazines. We would have just boxes and boxes of all these magazines. And they're so pretentious. There'd be some Austrian art house critic magazine. And by the way, I bet with your newsletters, how many of them are some curious piece about where capitalism will be in 100 years? You read the one article and then you moved on.
Matt, we've known each other a long time, so I shouldn't be surprised, but that is eerily accurate. Eerily accurate. Ooh, yeah. What a think piece on the future of capitalism. Click.
Oh, this is a condemnation of the Brookings Institute. I need to read more.
Yep. Bob in a nutshell.
And so, Matt. Yeah.
You're wine and I'm pretentious newsletters.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
I don't buy very much. I really don't. Oh, the other thing is books from the library. Do you realize there are times where I'll have 30 books out at the same time? I just keep going and going and going. I probably only read about, I don't know, I'm going to say 2 to 4% of them. I just love having them.
It's very aspirational. Like, you see that book, and that book is the reflection of the best case scenario of you, which is I'm going to read these books and I'm going to just ingest them and I'm going to be present in the moment, you know, and then the next thing you know, you're scrolling on Twitter or you're reviewing the 2003 NBA draft.
There are two kinds of people, Matt, that are interested in books. There are the people who are the sum total of the books they've read. And then everybody else who is the sum total of the books that they would have read.
Yeah.
And I am absolutely in the latter category.
Well, you do read a lot of them. It's just, you got a lot that are sitting there waiting.
Okay, hang on a second. On my desk right now, and you remember from back in the day what my desk is like. Oh, first one. Okay. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 books on my desk right now.
Jesus.
And I'm reading all of them right now.
What's the most pretentious of all of them?
Well, I'm reading The Tyranny of Merit by Michael J. Sandel. He's a Harvard philosopher. He's interesting. Mm-hmm. The Collected Poems of W.S. Merwin. Oh, no. Ding, ding, ding. Here we go. This is definitely the winner. The New York Times Essential Library of Classical Music, A Critic's Guide to the 100 Most Important Recordings by Alan Kozin. Although that's probably Walter J. Ong's Orality and Literacy, the technologizing of the word. But then I've also got the Beastie Boys book and screenplay
any
of
Apocalypse Grisham? Now.
Uh-huh. No, nothing from the vampire's point of view.
Yeah. That was some James Patterson or something about a murder or something.
Well, there's murder in some of these. Anywhoozle. So yeah. I wanted to, you know, we got a lot to get to today, obviously. I feel other than the Jays, the Toronto sports story is a bit played out right now. We're in a bit of a waiting period between scandals. Jack Campbell played pretty well last night, well enough to make him feel like the number one starter. The Raptors won, even though they barely beat Washington, and it's just so sad. The Jays are interesting, but why don't we start with football, Max? I really wanted your take on the Sam Darnold deal.
My first thought was, if you get any NFL writer who's under the age of 40, the one thing that is predictable is they are horny for draft picks. Mm-hmm. So they love this for the Jets because the Jets get a six round pick. And then the year after, a second and a fourth. So they are giving A minuses, B pluses to the Jets. Not as high on it for Carolina. That's the side thing. To me, this deal screams first of ego. The ego of the Carolina coaching staff. Because if they can turn around Sam Darnold, they get to look like they're so smart. And then the owner of the Panthers, David Tepper's the richest man in the NFL. He just needs to make splashes. So this is a splash. So I totally understand why Carolina did this. For the Jets, it was smart. You know, they're drafting a quarterback with the second pick. So it was kind of like, I understand the deal from both sides.
What's more likely, that a smart team could rehabilitate Sam Darnold or that you could find a really good quarterback with the number two pick?
Well, it's the number two pick is going to the Jets, so that's strike one. So I'll go with rehabilitate. You know, they got Christian McCaffrey. They've got some weapons there. There are smart people running Carolina. So I'll go with there's a better chance that Sam Darnold, like, put it this way. He's not going to be any worse in Carolina than he was with the Jets.
There's something about certain franchises. It's almost like the way they're set up, they're just cursed to fail. Remember when Mark Sanchez was going to be, you know, not a great quarterback, but somebody who could lead a good team deep in the playoffs? And he did. And it's amazing to me, like, you understand football better than I do. And one of the things I find so amazing about football is how you can go from Pro Bowl to stinks in a year. I've never seen another sport like this where it's not weird that someone is Pro Bowl and then the next year out of the league.
It's the simple explanation, and there's never one explanation, is that quarterback that made the Pro Bowl, they might have got hit a lot because they stood in the pocket that extra half second to be able to throw deep. And they got rewarded by long completions, but they got hit a lot. It's, right. it hurt Kurt, you know, that's what ended Kurt Warner, at least initially in St. Louis and then with the Giants. He somehow got his mojo back in Arizona. But that's part of it, is just sometimes you just get hit a ton.
That makes sense. And I'm actually wrong. Goaltending can be like that, and starting pitching can be like that, or pitching in general can be like that, where you can go from having a great year to never being good again almost within 12 months.
Yeah.
It does make big contracts at those positions seem kind of insane. And yet at the same time, because you feel like you have a safe bet, they're so rare. It's almost like Toronto property, where it's incredibly overpriced, but you know, if you can actually get in there, it's a steal and you need to do it. Like at any price, it's pretty much a steal because it's only going up.
I you know, it's funny about the long-term contracts. What immediately came to my mind was goalies. You know, like Bobrovsky, great year, bad year. Now I'm in a really good year with Florida. And I was making fun of the Islanders and that Rick DiPietro deal a while ago. Like, and then in baseball, I'm trying to think, like the Max Scherzer deal worked out, but so many of those long-term pitching deals just don't.
Clayton Kershaw works out, but, you know, these guys are outliers. They're the best in the game. And yet it's so valuable and so rare. How do you not do it? Because if you'd like, that's the game. That's why I made the point about Toronto real estate. Yeah, it's going up like crazy. But if you can get in there, it's worth it. You'll make money. It's just almost impossible to do. But anyway, going back to this whole thing about Carolina now, what I find interesting is in the shadow of Cam Newton, who felt like on the cusp of generational, on the cusp, just based on his physical talents. What do you do to rehabilitate the confidence of a kid like Sam Darnold? Like, how much do you try to simplify things? How much do you try to challenge him? Like, it must be so weird to look at this, and you're not starting from scratch. You're starting with a lot of baggage.
I mean, the first thing is, and this is a cliche, and I apologize, but the first thing is you have to protect him. You know, you have to make sure, and it's not about, you know, having the greatest offensive line, but you've got to be able to put them in a situation where they're not fearing they're going to get hit in 2.1 seconds after they drop back and pass. That's the first thing. And then it's just about, you know, what are you good at? Let's focus on that. Let's build out from that. It's coaches that put in a game plan that doesn't glorify the coach, but just makes life easier for Sam Darnold.
It's such a great point how in football, we love the coach that has a scheme and anybody can work in that scheme, right? Or you only draft people who could work in your scheme. And I suppose Bill Belichick is like the perfect example of that, right? But there have been others too, where they just have a way of doing things and they plug and play on players. I don't find that nearly as impressive as the coaches that can adjust from year to year based on the talent they actually have. This is based on just my real life experience with managers. Really good ones coach you up the way they want you to do it. The really great ones enable you to do it the way you do it. And it takes football coaches have such great egos. It's pretty rare that you find someone who says, I'm just going to work with what I got and not try to make it conform to how I see things.
Yeah. Like you should not have a coach's imprint shouldn't be, oh, that's a Mike Martz offense. I know what that looks like because there's always four wide and you're throwing deep all the time. It, you know, the best coaches are the ones going, okay, here's what I got. you know, okay, this is my puzzle today. How do I put this puzzle together? Versus I always do my puzzle this one way. Wait a minute. Why does this puzzle is only the color purple? My puzzles always have trees in it. What's going on?
Hey, you follow college football a lot more than I do. You'd have a much more intelligent opinion about this than me. But Urban Meyer going to Jacksonville. Isn't that always the problem when these college coaches who have had a lot of success in college go to the pros, is that they're used to doing it one way and guys fall into line because they're kids and the power dynamic is so much more tilted, if such a thing's possible, in college. You know, isn't it kind of a gamble to think a guy like that could go to the pros?
Here's the pro and con. It's always easy to rip on Urban Meyer, and he's deserved a lot of it. The con is that, you know, you look at a guy like Nick Saban, when he realized, wait a minute, I don't have all the power. I can't push these players to do what I want because they make more money than me and they can leave. Not like how it is in college where you basically are the king of your little fiefdom. But I'll give Urban Meyer credit. When he won a national championship in Ohio State, he did it with his third string quarterback, a guy named Cardale Jones, who got drafted. It didn't really do much, but this guy came in near the end of the season, and Urban Meyer was able to coach him up and scheme it. And I think it was against Alabama, and they were able to win a national championship with a third-string quarterback. So he has shown the ability to be flexible. We saw it in Florida with Chris Leak and then Tim Tebow. The question for me is, how okay is he with the power dynamic of the pro player versus the power dynamic of the 19-year-old kid?
To take it to basketball, John Calipari, great college coach, did not work in the NBA. Rick Pitino, great college coach, did not work in the NBA. Some of them can make it. Brad Stevens seems to have made the jump. And, you know, there are people calling for his head now. But, you know, he'd have a job tomorrow if he got fired today. So, you know, some guys do it. Some guys make the jump. It really does seem like your ability to work within the power structures is really what it comes down to. God, can you imagine how complex, you know, you mentioned about the NFL football writers under 40. One of the reasons why I think they often miss the point is because they haven't worked somewhere long enough to get how workplaces are. You know, they operate on the idea that everything is on paper and it's like you're balancing an equation or you're doing, you know, chemistry or something. Like things happen for so many bad reasons in the real world. Like the whole how it looks on paper exercise is meaningless. Like Carolina, yeah, okay, they gave up maybe more picks than they would have liked to, but you know, Deshaun Watson is probably out of the league for good, and Matthew Stafford got snapped up. So you got to do something.
Yeah.
It's not like teams don't know that. So all of a sudden, you know, it's like Chinatown. You got the knife up your nose. Roman Polanski's got the knife up your nose. Hey, kitty cat, how about a quarterback? That's a really obscure 70s movie reference.
It was. I appreciate it. By the way, the ending of Chinatown, not exactly a feel-good story. The Deshaun Watson, what's going on, and I think we're over 20 now women that are part of the civil suit, that is absolutely part of what's going on in Carolina. Because you know David Tepper would have been, you get me Deshaun Watson. Get him here no matter what. Well, that's out of play now. So I think that played a part in Sam Darnold heading to Carolina.
There is the plan you make and the one that life lets you have.
Yeah.
And this is just true all over the place. And like Dubas, I mean, to bring this quickly back to the Leafs, what might be a fair deal 2 years ago for Dubas while he's still building is not the same thing as what would be a fair deal for him now because he's on the cusp of winning. So, you know, we keep going back to the Taylor Hall thing. It's funny to me, like people who have been around a lot and have lost with the team for now generations are like, yeah, just make the deal. Like if you think it's going to win, like who gives a shit about Nick Robertson? Like he may or may not be good one day. La-di-da.
Yeah.
Get me a guy who can get me a key goal in a key situation on the power play in the second or third round. Like, but when you're, and it's not like I'm dissing the young because this is just the progression of things. Things don't make sense because you haven't realized yet that things don't make sense.
Time and wisdom. And again, it's not that like when you're, I mean, I mean, my God, so many of the geniuses, so many great works of art, of literature, of film have been done by men and women under the age of 30. So it's never about that. But yeah, there's a certain thing of where experience matters.
Hang on. I'm going to make this point about art, though. A lot of those things are done by position who are people who are in positions to exercise their creative will upon something. I think these are different things. Like running a team requires the ability to be flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hang on a second. That's my dad calling.
Nope.
Should I take it?
If you want to chat with your dad, I'll just quickly mention, I mean, if we're going to talk about wisdom and experience, well, one area you need that is, of course, if you need a lawyer.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry, Matt. This is just the way the pod's going to have to be until Charlotte's back in school.
I don't even know where I'm picking this up from because I was starting to do a lottery.
I was mentioning Jeff Pollock.
We'll just do this and I'll find a way to mash it together. But the important thing here, jeffpollock.com, 416-777-0088, 416-777-0088. If you need law help, we cannot recommend him high enough. Very good at his job. So if you need a lawyer, go grab Jeff Pollock. I don't know what the hell. Your dad was calling. What's going on with school, by the way? Let's just go there for a second.
Well, you may or may not have heard, but there is a third wave of COVID.
Yeah.
And the decision was made not to keep the kids home. And then some of the school boards themselves said, well, we're just not going to do this. My kid's school has another case of COVID. We got the note last night. And March break's coming up. You know what I find really weird? This is just something, a logical inconsistency I just don't get. So Lecce is making the case that moving forward, we should have options available for parents to do online schooling. This should just become part of the thing that kids could do, right? Because we like it. It's good. It's great. But in the middle of a pandemic, we can't shut the school down for 4 extra days because it's so detrimental to their mental health. So it's good. We should let them do it all year. But for the next 4 days, while cases are spiking, we can't keep them home because it would be too dangerous to their health at home, not at school, at home. The cynical part of me, and I wish I was wrong, but I can't think of a better reason not to, is March break's coming up and they're going to keep the kids home after March break because the numbers are going to continue to spike. And this way, Ford and Lecce and all that team can say, we blame it on the people who didn't listen to rules during Easter. So it's not how we handled it. It's on the people. The people did this. Not us, the people.
I mean, obviously, there has to be some truth to that when you see the inconsistent messaging about, you know, hey, this is good for the future, but not right now. My thing on, like, I have far less of a dog in this race. I don't think I used that expression right. My thing is a boring answer. Kind of everyone's to blame. Like, when I hear someone only blaming the government, I'm like, no. Human beings should also take some accountability. And then the other side, when, you know, if the government, if their messaging is this is all on the people, well, you're the one who also set the tone here. So you got to eat some of the shit as well.
So I'm going to give you some pushback on this because I'm pretty tired of the government of Ontario skating on the premise that this comes back to people just not listening. Listening mm-hmm. to what? Listening to what, Matt? Yorkdale is packed with people. Costco is packed with people. Small businesses are shut down. Why? Nobody knows. Nobody can figure out why. Numbers are skyrocketing. Things are dangerous. Stay home, but don't stop shopping. Keep going, but not to these places, only these places. And schools are fine. You can't go to a gym, but your children are fine in a school. The messaging has been so messed up and so self-serving and so clearly politicized that people don't really know how to take this. And these, you don't rely on your government for much, but what you do rely on it for is the kind of information that you yourself can't have. They have a team of experts. They're experts. They trot out that guy who looks like a shoe salesman, Williams. And he says, no, everything looks fine to me. I don't see anything. And then 700 doctors immediately write a note saying, what the hell are you talking about? So which experts are we listening to? They have thrown so many confused messages. And we talk about we have to prioritize the people who are in harm's way. Okay, but which ones? Because we will give it to long-term care. Okay, fine. I don't disagree with that. But warehouse workers, oh, no, you got to send them to work. We can't disrupt the supply chain. Teachers, oh yeah, they're frontline, but not the kind of frontline we're going to protect. You know, it's like they're all in for protecting people unless they're not. So I would argue, as much as, like, sure, have young people taken it seriously? Nah, probably not as much as they needed to. I think that's certainly true. But if we're looking at the balance, where I think your point of view is dangerous is it's a kind of a both sides-ism that allows no one to take a particular position. Everybody's wrong. So how could we blame anybody for anything if everybody's wrong? Well, you know, there are also percentages. And I would say this is probably about 80-20, the government fucking around versus, I actually think the Canadian public's been kind of amazing about it when you consider what we're going through, you know? And to blame people now in the midst of this incredibly mixed messaging, you know, like people, like they didn't shut anything down, Matt. It was like, okay, we think you should stay home for Easter, but we're actually not going to do anything else except tell you stay home for Easter. You know, it shouldn't be a surprise that a guy who ran on no platform doesn't have an opinion on how to do things later. Mm-hmm. He is totally just there to be a shirt and a haircut to stand in the place as a proxy for big business interests.
And ironic, you're not allowed to get a haircut. When I view this, I agree with you on percentages. Now, I think we'd probably quibble on the number. I don't think the government should be spending any time blaming the citizens. That does no good. And if we're doing percentages, the government is going to be the number one to blame. Just like for so long, the Maple Leafs, I don't blame. What was that, Bob?
That was just my, there's a lot going on today. People are trying to figure out like what to do with school. So I'm getting tons of calls. Mm. Sorry, Matt. I think we're just going to have to accept that this pod's messed up and figure out something better for Friday.
Yeah, so my point here is that when I look at how bad the Leafs have been in terms of playoff record over the last 20 years, I'm not blaming the defensemen. I'm blaming the general managers first. So I also agree in percentages. I always just get nervous if I see the messaging that it's all on the government. I do believe in personal responsibility. But yes, I agree with you. If you're going to look at the mess we're in right now, where does my attention go first? It first goes on the provincial government and it goes on the federal government.
So if Charlotte goes to school, she puts herself in harm's way, right? Mm-hmm. But if she doesn't go to school, she gets no education and nothing's being provided for her now because she can't go online because she didn't sign up at the beginning of the year. So the logic at the beginning of the year was, if you feel that you don't want to put your child in this risky position and no one says it's not risky, we owe it to you to make this available, right? This resource. Okay, that's what our taxpayer dollars have paid for. Okay, that seemed like a fairly reasonable allocation of cash. Now, in the midst of a dangerous third wave, they're saying the schools are totally safe and the kids, if they choose not to go to school, you know, if I don't send Charlotte to school within a 2-week range, that child services gets involved.
Really?
Mm. But they also are not offering online. In fact, as we've talked about on this pod, Charlotte's being taught by a TV right now because the teacher won't come into school and they can't find a human replacement. So she's being taught by a TV, but they are not allowed to send out the link so that she can study from home. Mm-hmm. I have no idea why. No one's explained it. But if Charlotte chooses to not go into that, or if we choose to not go into that with her, after a period of time, children's services get involved because we're doing something wrong. That to me is kind of an analogy for what's going on right now. You're right. We have the personal responsibility to send our kid into school. Would you?
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if I would.
Yeah. It's complicated, right?
Where the kid is, what the numbers are. It's complicated.
You know, we give a lot of tax dollars over to the government to manage situations like this. And they have basically punted because they don't want to be blamed for anything that they do. And what they have done is they've flipped it around to say, people, you haven't done a good enough job in the absence of us doing anything.
And that's wildly incorrect by the government. They shouldn't be doing that.
You know, so this whole personal responsibility thing, I can't disagree with you because in theory, it's true. But if you're given a whole bunch of shit options and you pick a bad one, you know, it could have been much better. When you find out like what we call essential services like Amazon, and there's close to 1,000 cases that have passed through that warehouse, you know, how do you justify sending people back in there?
I don't understand why, like a while ago, they didn't decide, okay, who's the one, where are the places that are the most outbreaks? Okay, those people get vaccinated first. I mean, once, I mean, you know, first long-term homes, you know, with the elderly, and then after that, it should have been factories, teachers, grocery store workers, and people working in public transportation.
You know, I don't think anybody would have done a good job of this because there's just a lot of shit sandwiches that you got to eat on this one. But the idea that you would start to blame frontline workers for asking for rights and blame parents for being confused by completely mixed messaging, that's where I get away from the personal responsibility thing. If people were effing up because they were indifferent, okay, that's fair. But people who can't figure out this slop of a message, I refuse to blame them for it.
Yeah, nor should they be blamed.
Anyway, I feel like we've gone hardcore on this. Let's do some sports.
All right. Russell Westbrook must be the most frustrating human being to root for. The man, like, if I'm Oscar Robertson, like, I'm distancing myself from Russell Westbrook. If I'm Oscar Robertson, I'm like, hey, I made the triple-double to be something that was revered. Russell Westbrook has made it a joke. Like that game last night, 8 straight misses, rushed shots. And you look at the stats and like, wow, 13 rebounds, 11 assists, 22 points. He was horrible. Like he's super competitive, super athletic. He fills up the box scores, but I have zero trust in him in terms of the ability to win games.
He was a student of Kobe. Early in his career, Kobe basically told him, sometimes you got to take over a game. And that's both a good and a bad message. And what you just described is the bad part of the message. The good stats, bad team guy. Mm-hmm. You almost wonder whether a guy like that can fit in on a team that's good. Or does he need players that are going to accept the idea that he's going to take the vast majority of chances for himself? Do you remember Ricky Davis once upon a time was on the cusp of getting a triple-double with the Cleveland Cavs, and he basically threw it off the backboard so he could catch the rebound at the end of the game.
Yep.
That to me is what the triple double has become. It's like some bizarre pseudo accomplishment that comes down to padding your stats almost always.
It was incredible. As for the Raptors, we're all torn by this. We all want them to lose by one and have the dignified tank. But if they're going to win games, that's how I want them to do it. Where Malachi Flynn is doing good things and Gary Trent Jr. is doing good things. Siakam for the first half was doing good things. Let OG Anunoby take a lot of shots. Like if they're going to win, great. Let it be because of that. Like it's weird to say, but I don't want them winning because Lowry and Van Vliet are playing 40 minutes a night. You know, let it be because Boucher is becoming a better defender versus just a guy who can get 4 blocks in a game.
It's a great point. I was so torn when I saw this morning because I watched about 10 minutes of last night's game. Not even 5, I'm going to say. You know, there was a big college basketball game on. Leafs are on. How much are you really going to dedicate to the Raptors now? And I saw that Gary Trent and Malachi Flynn were the big story this morning. And I thought at first, oh, God. I can't deal with that. That's the human victory cigar for somebody else when those guys are your, you know, that's what you're watching for. But your point's a good one, which is if you're a real fan, you want to see the development. Because if even just one of a handful of 3 or 4 guys turns into a really good contributor, you know, that's a form of success. You know, we saw this with the Jays and the pitching staff for about 2 years. It's, you know, you watch a lot, you know, you kiss a lot of frogs and you hope to get a prince. Gary Trent might just be jacking up shots and, you know, trying to find another contract. Malachi Flynn might be just a career backup. Who knows? Maybe Chris Boucher is going to be a nice story and he's going to be a guy who's your 7th or 8th guy off the bench. I don't know. I can't say I really have a feel for any of these guys right now.
But if these guys can become your next Norm Powell, Serge Ibaka, even younger Fred VanVleet, like that was the bench for the Raptors during their championship run. So if these guys can develop where they are high-end bench guys, can give you starter minutes for, you know, a couple of weeks of a season, well, that's valuable pieces. So that's the positive I take from last night.
you know, if Lowry does go for nothing, the whole, well, you know, Masai's a hero for not dealing him for nothing is going to not feel as good.
Yeah, that's true.
I am with you, though. I don't want to watch Fred, you know, jack up 40 shots. Yeah, let those guys sit. Let the young guys take over. There are no illusions anymore. They're a bad team. Let's just get a high draft pick and move on. Actually, they're not a bad team. They're quite a good team that's had a horrible year and a lot of terrible breaks. You know, we should probably talk. We talked about COVID and all this. We should probably talk about it with sports, because what's going on in Vancouver right now is really, really interesting and scary. I don't want to diminish it, like, because it's scary for the people involved and the families involved. But just as a league, what the hell do you do with that?
Yeah, and this is the point of the podcast where we say on the front end, the most important thing, and this is legit, is not just the players and the coaches' health, but their friends and family who might catch it. And what we've seen from this Brazilian variant is it's knocking players on their ass. And these are, you know, some of the most athletic, well-built, you know, healthy people in the world. So this is legit scary, and it ripped through a team that is isolated, that isn't working in a factory or taking the subway all the time. So it is a big deal from the hockey standpoint. The first thing I'll say, the cynic in me, the NHL 's got to be thinking, thank God it's not Tampa and Colorado. Now that is cold and cynical by me, but this story is even bigger if it's one of the true elite, if it was Toronto versus a Vancouver team that was probably not going to make the playoffs anyway.
Toronto would be the worst one because of the media attention on it. If it was Colorado or Tampa Bay, it would be terrible. In the sense that one of your marquee franchises goes down, but just in terms of generating press, the first thing I thought of is, what if 14 or 20 or whoever many it is now, 14 people connected with the Leafs went down with COVID? We would hear about this 24/7 every day for a month.
Oh, 100%. We would. And also, let this be a reminder of everyone to be careful, because if, as I said, the range of people who have gotten COVID, if Ellen and the Vancouver Canucks can get COVID, you at Yorkdale buying jeans, you can also get COVID.
What do you do if you're the Players Association? And like, it just struck me, if I was on the Leafs right now and I saw a whole team go down the way they did, and you remember how the Mumps carved through teams a couple of years back? I think Pittsburgh, and I can't remember who else, it might have been Anaheim, but there were just a bunch of guys that came down with mumps all at the same time. They're in such close quarters with each other constantly. And I know that teams are taking precautions, but it's a recipe for disaster, particularly with the more contagious strains, you know, faster to pass through people to others. If you're the PA, do you say anything? I mean, I know the teachers' union is starting to say stuff. Different unions have said stuff. They're a union. How much can you protect guys who are making millions of dollars to play a game?
Well, in this case, you know, I think the players want to play. Mm-hmm. I think they're willing to take that risk. I think that, you know, what happens now is you know, this is the boring answer. You keep them out as long as it takes until everyone has passed, you know, multiple negative tests. And, you know, this still could be unfair, much like with the Raptors, much like with Jason Tatum, where this is going to impact them more. There might be guys that aren't going to have the conditioning ready. So it's going to be, you're calling up players from, you know, your minor systems. You know, the players wanted to do this. They could have opted out. They're taking the risk. And the most important thing is that no one gets rushed back. That's the first thing that has to be done.
That's an important one. And obviously, we don't understand how these guys, because they're high-performance athletes and it's a new variant. And we've seen on the Raptors how guys have said, you know, I've hit the fourth quarter and I'm running out of steam.
Yep.
Your point's a really good one about these are literally the fittest people in the world. So there's just so many things, so many variables. It's hard to know how they should respond, how they will respond. I'm not sure the players do want this. I think they do, and I think they don't. I think it's more complicated than just players want to play. I think players want to play because this is their career, and this is where, you know, they've trained their whole lives to get here. But I don't know. Like, one of the things that's so hard about this moment in time is it's a lot of things all at once, you know? Like, I do want to send my kid to school, but I don't want to put her in harm's way and put us in harm's way because of it. But I don't want to cause her harm because I'm keeping her at home. Like, all of these things are true at the same time. And I feel so badly for these players because people will accept my confusion. I don't know that we'll accept the players' confusion in the same way.
I think right now the NHL, you know, has to throw it out there to any of these players. If you want to opt out, there will be no punishment. You know, there's 19 games left. Like, if you want to opt out, fine. And I think there'll always be a slice of the population that'll be angry. But they're always just going to be angry. I think for the most part, I don't think there'd be a lot of think pieces or opinion pieces on these players are cowardly, scared, disloyal, or whatever. If any player right now wants to sit the rest of it out, I don't think anyone would care. And I go to the New England Patriots. That's Boston. I didn't hear anyone going, you know, Deonta Hightower, what a traitor.
I think you're right, Matt. I don't think it's that conversation. I actually feel like if this were to happen to another team, we start to get into guilty pleasure territory as fans.
Yep.
And for example, I was reading stuff about the production of meat and the environment over the weekend. And really, there's no way to justify it. Like, if you eat a lot of meat, you're just contributing to a system that chews up a ton of resources and it's bad for the planet. And there's no other way around it. Like, it just is that way. The science is conclusive at this point. But I don't want to be a hypocrite because I also ate meat that day and I ate meat the next day as I was reading it. And I'm trying to figure out what's my relationship to this. And I think if you pay attention, everything is a guilty pleasure. So I'm watching hockey and I'm thinking about the Leafs and I'm thinking, God, this must be really hard on these guys. But I'm also thinking, wow, this is a good season. And they got a chance to do something they haven't done in a really long time. So I expect them to barrel through. But
also, Bob, I'll say this, and like, you know, trust me, I have tons of empathy for the players. I talk about it all the time that the problem with, as sports fans, is sometimes it's hard to have empathy for an athlete because they don't look like us. They can by what they can do athletically, and they make a lot of money. So there's these barriers of empathy. But also watching that Leafs game last night, I also saw lots of joy and lots of happiness and probably also a lot of satisfaction that, you know, they put the time and the energy into this and now they are being, you know, creatively, professionally rewarded. If they don't want to be there, they don't have to be. And listen, they're going through tough stuff as well. Their lives are turned upside down because they're all about schedules and their schedules are, you know, they're creatures of habit. And that got done away with all the testing and things they have to do. So it does stink for them, but this is also their choice.
I've watched a lot about how the entertainment industry has tried to continue, and it's been really hard. And we all have responsibilities, and we all have expectations of ourselves and those that are put on us. And I've heard a lot of people talk about how we have to be empathetic towards each other during this time because there's just stressors everywhere. And I think we all acknowledge that up to the point where we don't want to give up anything, though. We're willing to listen to people up to the point that your feelings might actually keep me from getting what I want. I see this in the workplace all the time. I see this just in culture all the time. Everybody wants to be on the side of the angels until they have to sacrifice something. And, you know, I'm trying to enjoy sports this year, but a part of me in the back of my mind just keeps thinking, this is just contributing to the idea that things are normal. And that's fraught because, yeah, people need normal in order to keep going. I get that. I feel that. I am like that. I'm happy they're playing because it makes me feel less messed up that things are this messed up. On the other hand, it also contributes to decisions of people who are like, you know, we got to send the kids to school. We got to try to soldier on. We got to try to do this and that and the other thing. Not really acknowledging the gravity of our situation. We do this all the time. So I find myself in this really weird and undesired bind where I'm not even sure if I can enjoy this stuff because I can't decide if it speaks to my own selfishness or just my own natural instinct to need something to keep going.
But then what's the solution? Is the solution that no sports should be played? Because I would have bet more than the majority of players, they don't want that solution. They want to play. A, because they know their careers are short. B, they have economic reasons as well. Also, every time a sport is played, there's thousands of other people that have jobs. Like, I get the guilt, but then if someone's going to lament that having sports is doing negative, then my question is, what's the alternative? What's the better solution?
I get that. And you're right to say focus on the solutions. But then we ask ourselves, do we make the right choice by saying, well, let's just move ahead? 500,000 people died in the States. 500,000. Mm-hmm. Like that's like World War territory.
Yep.
And everybody was sort of like, but we can't stop going now because we need things to be normal. And then 500,000 people died. I almost feel like it's such a big reality that we haven't even really wrapped our brains around it. And the biggest reason all these people died is because nobody wanted to change what we were doing.
I don't know how do you want me to respond to that?
I don't know. Honestly, like this is one of those moments that's tough. Like, look, I'm not presenting this. I'm just saying this is the conundrum that I face is I feel selfishly I want this stuff to continue. I also recognize it might be contributing something to something that's really bad.
If I'm just being honest and laying my cards on the table, if I just said on the podcast I have that same level of guilt or concern, then I'll get looked at as a better person. But honestly, I don't have that same level of guilt or concern. I'm fully good with players. If they don't want to play, never once have I ripped anyone for it. And if anyone has a concern, then don't play. But if the majority of players do, and you know, these leagues, you know, we see how different the games look. I when I watch games, I enjoy it, but I don't feel we're in a normal state. You know, I watch the games and every time I watch a game, I'm reminded of just how different things are because nothing looks the same now as it did 2 years ago.
I think that's all true. Everything you said there, I'm willing to go with, except for one thing,
yeah,
which was the idea that, you know, if someone presents this, it's like there's a form of virtue signaling. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's true. I think to have questions about what's the right way to do things and to be critical of things that are complicated is not necessarily virtue signaling. I think that's kind of what's missing from public discourse right now is people just saying, okay, well, why are we doing this? And when it gets thorny, you know, we have to have the courage to sort of keep going. I think there are people who use that as opportunities to virtue signal, but generally they're the ones who have answers ready-made and not so much the people who have questions that just keep pushing and pushing. So I wouldn't say anybody who feels guilty about this and expresses that is virtue signaling.
Oh, I'm not saying that. Yeah. No, Bob, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. I need someone to show me the numbers that say because hockey's being played, that directly led to X amount of deaths. I need to see, you know, all that sort of evidence.
And maybe that's not the case, but maybe let me throw you another hypothetical. Let's say we shut down all sports leagues. And we said, you know what, right now, the public health crisis is at a point where this is just distracting and probably not guaranteeable in terms of safety and probably more money than anybody should spend, even if it's people's own money, you know, whatever. I guess maybe that argument's not relevant. But let's just say for argument's sake, we said there's a public health crisis. We're just going to shut everything down. Would we have as a society have taken this more seriously?
If you went full, everything is shut down. Yeah,
right.
But then the other side to that is what are the impacts of having everything shut down?
Well, it's hard to know because we're talking about a hypothetical, but
yeah.
what we've seen in other countries is that they've been able to keep a tighter lid on things for longer. So they take a greater hit in the short period, but they haven't had the big prolonged hit. And the economists will be sorting this out for a long time. Pardon me?
Yeah. Yes. I know Italy's in another one. Like I have no idea. Like when I hear about the success story of New Zealand, I think that's fantastic, but it also has the population of Mississauga.
But that's not true in Shanghai.
What's that?
That's not true in Shanghai. You know, like, you know, a lot of people live there. I think it just came down to how did you want to treat this in a lot of cases? And the countries and the people that tended to focus on let's just zip it up tight right out of the gate have avoided the prolonged thing that we've been in. Now, that's not to say there won't be flare-ups, but like, you know, they shut down stuff for 7 cases in some parts of the world. You know what I mean? Like, we just have not chosen to do that. And you know what? There are good reasons for this because we value certain personal freedoms. And that's one of the great things about living in the West.
Do we have the military and police presence to, if you really want to shut things down, do you have to get it to a certain level of draconian to be able to enact it?
I think there's a certain amount of fear mongering that goes around that idea that sort of ties into the conservative fantasy that, like, in order to have a collective public movement or initiative, that somehow you're going to have to be out there to crack skulls. You know, I think that if you would have told people that we're really going to zip this up for 2 months and at the end of it, we should be okay, I think a lot of people would accept that.
Well, there were no sports for March, April, May, June, you know, for the first like 4 months.
But as soon as we could, we opened things right back up. And even when numbers started to spike, like what we've seen, and this is the one problem that it's one of the many problems I have, but my biggest problem with how the government has handled this is the sudden scramble at the very end of the messaging to say we're in a really bad spot. All of the graphs pointed to exactly this spot. Everybody said this was happening. Like literally everybody, Matt. If you picked up the newspaper every single day, they said numbers are rising. There was not a scientist worth their salt in the world that would have said, well, we think that'll just taper off on its own without some kind of behavior modification. So they knew this, and they've just been dicking around the whole time. And my point is, it ties back into this philosophy that people can't handle it. They need to be coaxed along. Well, that has proven to be a dangerous philosophy. If we would have just tackled this more head on and said, look, here are the facts. Every time we loosen up, we invite this thing back in. But if we buckle down really hard, there is a much better chance that we could actually put a lid on this thing for longer. And that will be better in the long time for the economy. It'll be terrible for, we have the money, we have the reserves. God, a lot of money's been thrown around. We have the reserves to get small business through for 2 or 3 months or whatever the period is. But at the end of it, we're going to survive and we're going to be okay. We're going to give the money to people. We're not going to give it to big business. You know, I just keep coming back to this idea that sometimes when I watch sports, it feels like this is the fiction that allowed us to get duped. Mm-hmm. Like we're endorsing things to try to pretend things are normal, and it just keeps screwing up.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's just one way you and I are different in terms of how we consume sports. I never look at it through that lens. I agree with you in terms of just the government's inability to handle this correctly. But then I guess when it comes back to sports, I wonder, were there any COVID flare-ups directly related to, you know, golf coming back or basketball or things like that? Because most of the sports have been a success when the NBA and the NHL in their bubbles, there were no stories of flare-ups at Disneyland or, you know, with the Tampa Bay Lightning. So I think, you know, I sometimes just go to, okay, what are the numbers in terms of what are sports doing? And I get what you're saying. It's more of an existential. Sports promotes normalcy. Normalcy promotes people not, and governments not doing what they should to clamp down on COVID.
I don't think anybody would argue that their lives were ruined because they couldn't go to the movie theaters. Are we saying that sports are that different than movies? That somehow sports are an essential service? That without them, we couldn't continue on as a culture?
Oh, no, of course we could. We could fully go on. There would be ramifications, but of course we could.
You know, so I kind of feel like, I don't know, it's funny because this is primarily a sports podcast, right?
Yeah.
And you and I love sports, and I've made my living from sports more than half my professional career. And going back to the time when I was like 5, 6 years old, and I first started getting into baseball and hockey, it has given me more joy than maybe anything else in the world. You know, certainly up there with books and movies, you know, and you and I have had this conversation. It's all in this great gumbo in our heads, right? Like sports, movies, entertainment, comics. You know, maybe this was needlessly existential in some ways, but at the same time, like when the Canucks went down, this is what it made me think of, which is everything that we thought was safe and good about this was bullshit. And the number one conversation has been, well, what is this going to do to the schedule? And it feels like the wrong conversation. It's like, well, what does this do to those people's lives?
I'll tell you from my end, the conversation has been much more about those players' lives.
Yeah, I think you're probably different, though. And then a lot of people, like most of the conversation I've seen is like, how does the league soldier on? But, you know, whatever. I'm getting a lot of texts. I don't know if you've noticed.
No, you've been on silent. Good for you.
No, I just got one. I think I just got one. Maybe I didn't. I don't know.
I didn't hear anyway, it. Trust me. I didn't hear it.
You know, sometimes I feel like the Bruce Arthur, Debbie Downer of stuff. And I certainly don't mean to do that, you know. everybody I've talked to recently is exhausted.
Yeah.
Like really genuinely exhausted. They're tired of worrying all the time. They're tired of feeling under threat of harm all the time. They just miss people. And we're so close to the end if we can just vaccinate properly. And I wonder to what extent, maybe to back up your point, Matt, we just need a little sports to get us through this. Like maybe now it's the exact opposite, which is we don't need normal. We need to feel like we can do it.
I'll say this, and we got to end. We're now basically at an hour. I don't view any of what you said, your opinions, at all as Debbie Downer. It's a very legitimate point of view that's shared by many, many people.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure if I think it, to tell you the truth, because I can see counterarguments that are really strong. Maybe I want to end up on this thought, which is I would like us to all get to a place where nobody's afraid to ask questions. I'm not in a hurry to defend people who want to have idiot takes and say, oh, free speech. You know, technically it's true, but I'm not in any hurry to defend it. If people say stupid things, you know, they're grownups, they can live with it. But I don't want people to get hammered for having what are reasonable questions. You know, when we get to that place, then we drive everyone to a place of fear and ignorance, and then there is no progress. So I kind of feel good that we had a chance to talk this out, and hopefully people have been asking themselves these same kinds of questions at home in their lives, like, how do I make sense of all this stuff? Not just about sports, but in every way. Like, you know, each one of our pods is different, and this one maybe is a bit more existential, as you say, because I am right now. but I don't know. I just hope somebody listened to this and thought, yeah, I've been wondering a lot of the same stuff myself too, you know?
I hope people focus more on this than the opening where Matt is full of shit.
It's going to be the headline though.
It's going to be the headline. Bye, Bob.
Bye, Matt.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.